Good morning and welcome. The Free Congregation of Sauk County is a Unitarian Universalist Fellowship and a welcoming congregation. That means that our invitation is to all and that all are welcome here, regardless of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender expression, or political persuasion. It turns out there aren't many adult biographies of Clara Barton, but there are seem to be dozens of books for children about her. And this is just one of them, reminding us that when there are disasters, floods, fires, earthquakes, the Red Cross shows up, and that has because of Clara Barton. She was the smallest in her family and very shy, but because of these older brothers and sisters, she learned to read, play games, and ride horses at an early age. And she became a school teacher. And she impressed the boys because she could play their sports. She got a job in the patent office, which was unusual for a woman, and you'll hear more about that. But when the Civil War broke out, she wanted to help. Some of the boys she had taught were now in the army, and she started gathering supplies for them. Eventually, there was an entire warehouse. She wanted to get these things to the battlefield. Finally, she got permission. Not only did she bring the supplies, but she helped take care of the men. She brought them drinks. She made food. She wrote letters. And she assisted soldiers, wounded soldiers of both sides. And at one, as you'll hear a bill about this later, but she was holding up a soldier to give him a drink when she felt something twitch her sleeve. A bullet passed through her sleeve without hitting her arm. Unfortunately, went into his body and killed him. She never mended the hole in her sleeve. She began to speak around the country to raise funds. After the war, she went to Europe, and there she learned about a group that was doing similar work. The International Red Cross was helping injured and ill people on both sides of the war. She decided the United States should have this. And after a long time of campaigning, she was able to get that established. Then she decided that the Red Cross should work not just in war, but in all sorts of disasters, and should have an education component. So that's why today you can take first aid classes at the Red Cross, and children can even get babysitting certifications. She lived to be over 90 and was quite celebrated in her time. So that's our brief introduction. My quote is from Clara Barton. I kind of identify with this one. I have an almost complete disregard of precedent and a faith in the possibility of something better. It irritates me to be told how things have always been done. I defy the tyranny of precedent. I go for anything new that might improve the past. The subjects of my talks seem to fall into different categories. Many of them elicit the response, who? For instance, last time I talked about Catherine Spence from Australia, who nobody had ever heard of, including me, or Frances Harper, our Black Unitarian foremother. And then there are some we've heard of, but we know one thing, like Julia Ward Howe wrote the Battle Hymn of the Republic, but there was much more to her. And then there are subjects that we know quite a bit about, and who have been written about a lot, like Abigail Adams or Louisa May Alcott, or today's topic, Clara Barton. Clara was the fifth and last child born on Christmas Day, 1821, to a Massachusetts family. From the age of three, she went to school with her older brothers. She learned to read early and was encouraged by her family. And she was also fascinated by her father's tales of his time as a captain in the Indian Wars. She and her brothers enacted battles and played with tin soldiers. She learned to throw a ball, use tools, and do mathematics, and ride bareback. But her mother's training in cooking and sewing was to come in just as handy as her courage under fire. Clara's parents, Stephen and Sarah, were active Universalists. The Universalist Creed stated that everyone could be saved, so this was quite a departure from most of the religions that either said you had to earn this or you were was decided at birth whether you were going to be saved or not, and nothing you did could help. And I use this biography, Clara Barton, Professional Angel, by Elizabeth Brown Pryor. It says, the Universalists were socially aware, interested in abolition, education, and charity. Clara's mother, Sarah, had signed abolitionist petitions and believed in women's rights. So this was early, this was 1830s, 1820s. Clara later wrote, I must have been born believing in the full right of woman to all privileges and positions. When, as a young woman, I heard the subject discussed, it seemed simply ridiculous that any sensible, rational person should question it. Although she was small and shy, young Clara was also described by her biographers as smart, athletic, kind, practical, generous, and all the other scout virtues. It certainly is true that when her beloved brother David fell while helping build a barn and was badly injured, Clara devoted her years between age 11 and 13 to nursing him. When David finally recovered, she felt a loss of purpose that would shadow her life between campaigns of furious activity. Like many other young women with academic success and little money, Clara became a teacher at age 18, and these were the one-room schoolhouses. She won the respect of the boys in the class by beating them at sports. And something I wasn't going to put in the children's part was, apparently she recounted that she had to whip one who most resisted her authority, but that nipped all insubordination in the bud, and she never needed to resort to physical discipline again. Clara continued to be active in the Universalist Church, though she actually described herself as a well-disposed pagan. And it was true of most of the women I've studied that as they advanced in their knowledge and experience, they tended to outgrow the churches of their time. Even among the Unitarians and Universalists, ministers and boards were men. And the services and practices were very traditional. So I'd like to think that some of these women would be at home today in our congregations. After 10 years of teaching, Clara decided to open her own school, one of the first free schools in New Jersey, because early on, as in England and many other countries, there were fees that had to be paid to send your child to school. The school grew from 6 children to 60 in 1 year, and within 2 years, funds were approved to build a school that could hold 600. But the school board would only consider a man to run this new institution. Through a family friend, Clara found a clerk's job in the patent office in Washington, D.C. The salary of $1,400 a year was high for a woman of the era. She wasn't universally popular with her coworkers because her industriousness made the slackers look bad. This was before civil service, and these were patronage jobs. Plus, the department manager labeled women in the workplace as an impropriety. But her immediate supervisor stood up for Clara. The biographer Pryor says, it is difficult today to imagine the degree to which Barton's aggressiveness and capability appeared unusual and in many ways unacceptable in the 1850s. Such traits were the opposite of those preferred in the Victorian woman. While Clara did meet some eligible young men, she seems not to have had or indeed desired a serious relationship. Because these were patronage jobs, they would change with each administration. Clara was let go when a new president came in, although she did admire him. It was Abraham Lincoln. Eventually, she was actually invited back to her old department, though the rate of pay had diminished. Still, she was at the center of government when Fort Sumter fell. The rumor was that D.C. itself would be attacked within 6 weeks. When soldiers began appearing in the city, bedraggled from their travels, or later, ill and wounded, Clara began collecting supplies, visiting soldiers, writing letters for them, and organizing other women to sew and knit for the troops. She lobbied government officials, churches, and other groups for support of money and supplies. Some of the officers supervising the injured troops opposed the idea of women in their hospitals on the grounds that women were too emotional, too weak, or too unreliable. Of course, women were the main ones caring for sick people at home at the time and dying people. As it turned out, there were so many needs that no one could stop Clara from showing up and being useful. Eventually, her supplies filled a warehouse, but what she really wanted was to go to the battlefield. She got her chance in August 1862 after the battle in Virginia, which is called Culpeper or Cedar Mountain. The soldiers and the doctors were grateful to receive supplies of bandages, salves, stimulants, food, and drink. From this first encounter, they began to describe Clara as an angel appearing out of nowhere, in this case during the night, bearing supplies and jumping in to help wherever needed. Although this was her first exposure to the severity of war casualties, Clara never flinched. At the battlefield, she always wore dark skirts, left off any hoops and other adornments, and pinned up the skirts to keep them off the ground and allow more freedom of movement. She assisted surgeons in amputations, rode horses astride, and slept on the ground or in tents. And you've certainly read and seen things about the Civil War medicine, which contained a lot of amputations and also a lot of infections because there were antibiotics. And also no anesthetics, some whiskey and a bullet to bite on was about it. Clara was not always safely behind lines, as we saw in one battle. She said she felt a twitch on the sleeve of her dress. "The poor fellow sprang from my hands and fell back, quivering in the agonies of death. A bullet had passed between my body and the right arm, which supported him, cutting through the sleeve and passing through his chest from shoulder to shoulder." While Clara became a figure of legend to her boys, as she called them, her reception by Army officials varied. Her supplies were always welcome, but sometimes she was forced to travel behind long convoys, delaying her arrival when the supplies were really needed. Many in the military still questioned the effectiveness and propriety of a woman at the scene. And then there was the Official Sanitary Commission, which got started under Dorothea Dix. As they became more powerful and organized, they questioned Clara's independent ways. Clara did find a few women who were up to the task of working with her. One of these was Frances Gage, also a Universalist. Now, here's somebody I'll be talking about in the future because I had never heard of her. But the biographer says, Gage's influence caused Barton to widen her conception of equal rights to include rights for Negroes. Clara had never had a particular interest in this cause. Now her eyes were open to the difficult position of the newly emancipated blacks. That is, many people were for abolition, but hadn't thought much about what would happen to these freed people. Between campaigns and throughout her life, when a lull in activity appeared, Barton suffered from depression and various physical ailments. At one of these moments during the war, when she was out of the action, she wrote, "I cannot raise my spirits. The old temptation is to go from all the world. I think it will come to that someday." That is, she was feeling suicidal. So, unfortunately for the country, but luckily for her, the war resumed. At the Battle of Fredericksburg, Clara assisted with amputations and other operations and slept on a straw mat in a tent with a dirt floor. Doctors worked by lantern or candlelight or outdoors under blazing sun and swarming insects. At this battle, General Butler said, "Honor any request that Miss Barton makes without question. She outranks me." It would naturally seem that once the Civil War finally ended, Barton would go back to a day job or to her family. But she took on a new cause. A month before Lincoln's death, he sent her the following note to use in her next project. "To friends of missing persons, Miss Clara Barton has kindly offered to search for the missing prisoners of war. Please address her at Annapolis, giving the name, regiment, and company of any missing person. Signed, A. Lincoln." Barton had been shocked to learn that there were few records of prisoners of war and of the dead. This was an era before dog tags, and certainly no other kind of recording. Some soldiers pinned their name and address or that of their kin to their coats in case they fell in battle. Prisoners had sometimes been exchanged with no records kept at all. Once the mission was announced, Barton was flooded with letters inquiring about missing men. It was a Herculean task, and she had no assistance or funding. General Grant finally arranged for her to get free transportation and a small amount of money. Clara's mission took a sudden turn when she received a letter from a young man named Dorrance Atwater. At 18, he had joined the Union Army, was soon taken prisoner by the Confederates, and sent to the infamous prison at Andersonville. Pryor explains, he was assigned to the task of recording the name, rank, and cause of death of any prisoner who expired. When the numbers of dead topped 700 per week, Atwater began to suspect that Confederate officials might try to hide evidence of the brutal treatment they meted out by falsifying the records. He therefore began to copy the official register secretly. Each night he hid his own copy in the lining of his jacket, and at the war's end he was able to smuggle it safely to the North. This young man, Dorrance Atwater, accompanied Clara and a group of laborers and craftsmen to the Andersonville site. They were the first to enter it since the war, and the first to document the fate of many of the men who died there. So they actually set up graveyards, labeled the gravestones as they could from his records. Ironically or tragically, the Army decided to court-martial Atwater for the, quote, theft of the lists. Maybe he was a sort of whistleblower. Clara had no influence in the right quarters for this. He received little in the way of legal defense and was condemned to 18 months in prison and marched through the streets in chains. Clara's name did not come up in the trial, but she felt responsible. It turned out he was released early under a general presidential pardon for lesser offenses from the military. So at this point, she had no job. Clara had no job, no income, and no mission, and she sank again into depression. But after submitting a request to Congress and testifying, possibly the first woman to testify before a U.S. Congress, she received an appropriation of $15,000 for the work of identifying dead and missing soldiers. It was quite a bit at the time. She began to lecture around the country. Her speeches with graphic and emotional details from the war were highly popular. The material was melodramatic, but newspapers reported that she spoke calmly and quietly and was very effective. She never enjoyed these tours, suffering from stage fright and the exhaustion of constant travel, but the fees and donations collected helped sustain her work. And during this time, there was a famous meeting. On the last day of November 1867, while changing trains in Cleveland, Barton met Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, who were also engaged in a lecture tour. This is the first recorded instance of their meeting, which marked the beginning of a long and productive relationship, especially between Barton and Anthony. By 1867, Barton no longer had doubts about the need to expand women's political and social rights. The war, she maintained, had proven the sincerity of women who wanted to contribute to society, had shown them as a political force in every soldier's aid society and abolitionist rally. Further, it was not only men who had been convinced of female competence during these years, but the women themselves. Anthony advertised Barton's lectures, and Barton became a regular speaker at Anthony's conventions and rallies. Barton, with her unique history, began to rally Army veterans to the cause of women's rights, as they had seen the power of women like Barton under the most severe hardships. As the work of locating missing soldiers ebbed, Clara again suffered from inactivity and was advised to travel. She certainly did. She sailed across the ocean to England, Scotland, and the continent. There she was to find the next step in her life's work. Everyone has heard of the Geneva Convention, but you may not know it stems from an actual meeting of humanitarians in Geneva in 1864. Among other things, this group authorized international Red Cross groups to provide neutral relief during wartime. The United States did not yet have such an organization, and it was a new idea for Clara. Meanwhile, while she was in Europe, she went to help victims of the Franco-Prussian War. From this point on, her work was not so much with hands-on nursing and bringing supplies, but more about establishing local committees and industries to get the communities back on their feet. For instance, she organized women to sew clothing for those who needed it. And it reminds me a bit of the World Central Kitchen with Chef Jose Andres, which comes to areas of war and disaster and gets local people to be able to work and be paid. So it's a similar kind of idea. At the end of her trip, and for some time after her return, Clara was again very ill. She was now in her 50s, and her hair had turned white. She wasn't helped by the typical therapies of the time, which were often very frightening for us to read about, but finally she went to a sanatorium where they had good food, fresh air, rest, and intellectual stimulation. At 56, Clara needed something more to do, and she found it in the International Red Cross. That group appointed Clara their representative for the United States, and she decided to convince the U.S. government to join the organization. The Red Cross was increasingly devoting resources to peacetime activities, floods, earthquakes, storms, and so on. Then as now, the United States was wary of entering into any compact that might attempt to dictate its behavior. And there are a number of international agreements that the United States is one of the few holdouts today because of this type of attitude. Her failure to engage the U.S. government in her plan led to another bout of depression for Clara. But after years of lobbying, she was finally able to initiate the American Red Cross in 1881. Now, one problem was that during these years while she was working for it, rival groups had sprung up with names like the White Cross or the Order of the Red Cross. Those groups were not eager to give up power to join Barton's international team. And once the Red Cross itself was constituted, there were often battles between national and local entities. Clara Barton's vision was of local offices loosely headed by the national organization. You might be interested to know that one of the very first local groups was in Madison, Wisconsin. The new Red Cross needed money and recognition. A series of high-profile disasters put them front and center for the public. For example, in 1882, the Mississippi River flooded New Orleans. Suddenly, Clara was approached for a very different role. She was asked to take on the job of superintendent of the Women's Reformatory Prison of Massachusetts. There were about 240 inmates, and Clara's first impression was that the misdeeds of the women did not seem to her very great. Charges ranged from stubbornness and vagrancy to illegally practicing abortion, abandonment of a child, offenses against chastity, which could be prostitution or adultery. The most common crime was drunkenness, for which half the women had been sentenced. Some of the officials in the prison condemned the women and treated them badly, but Clara had sympathy for them and even fought to have one woman's unjust sentence reversed. Clara worked there for only 8 months. Although she undoubtedly brought needed reforms in attitudes and practices, she found it mostly depressing and later called it the most foolhardy thing I ever did. She wanted to return to her real mission of boosting the Red Cross. She was back at the Red Cross when the Ohio River flooded in 1884. She not only worked in person at the site, but headed what we would call a PR operation, making sure the newspapers had touching human interest stories to report. This caused contributions and volunteers to pour in. Working along the river, Clara included Black residents in her local committees to be sure that their community's needs were met. At 62, Clara's health and strength were waning, but when the U.S. Secretary of State insisted, she was the only person who could properly represent America at the upcoming Third International Conference of the Red Cross in Geneva, she agreed to go. This was the first appointment of any woman as a diplomatic representative for the U.S., and she was the only woman there. Clara was internationally known and received numerous tributes at the convention. By this time, Clara saw that the great need was not for simple handouts, but for a future-oriented program that relied on seed, tools, and the determination to begin again. The Red Cross showed up for the Johnstown flood in 1889 and the Sea Islands hurricane off South Carolina in 1893. Biographer Pryor states, "Of the major relief fields undertaken by Barton's Red Cross, the Sea Islands were undoubtedly the greatest. With inadequate provisions, a tiny workforce, and against a skeptical press, they sustained 30,000 people through a precarious year." Meanwhile, Clara continued to lobby Congress for official status that would stop the flood of merchandise and groups using the Red Cross name and symbol without permission. Clara was still going strong, and at the age of 70, she took a camping trip in the West with a group, sleeping in tents and eating the game and fish they caught. At 74, retirement age for most of us, an old age in the 19th century, Clara was invited to travel to Turkey to help earthquake survivors. And you can imagine what it entailed to make a journey like that at this time. The distance involved and problems of language, culture, and money exchange complicated the urgent work of helping survivors and preventing widespread disease. It took 6 weeks for communications to get back and forth to U.S. headquarters. Throughout her career, Clara was dogged by accusations of improper use or improper documentation of funds. She admitted that administration wasn't her strongest point. She was always devoted to specific tasks on the ground and in the moment. Certainly, Clara got no monetary gain from any of her work. Rather, she often used her own money for supplies and transportation. Some staffers just seemed to be jealous of her international fame. And like many superachievers, she may not have been the most diplomatic or flexible person to deal with. Clara's next call was to Cuba, where revolts had broken out against the Spanish government. She got there in time to admire the beautiful battleship Maine and to lunch on board with the captain 2 days before it blew up, launching the U.S. into the Spanish-American War. Teddy Roosevelt showed up at her location needing supplies. He wasn't willing to wait for someone to deliver them, so he filled a huge sack and carted it off himself. In 1902, at the age of 79, Clara traveled to St. Petersburg, Russia, as an honored guest of the 7th International Red Cross Conference. She even met the Tsar. Barton had tried to write her memoirs, partly to explain and justify her actions throughout her career, but she ended up writing two shorter books, one a history of the Red Cross and one a story of her childhood. In the latest stages of her career, Clara expanded the Red Cross to cover preventive and educational services, and this is why today you can take first aid training and donate blood and so on through the local Red Cross. Toward the end of her life, Clara enjoyed new inventions, including the typewriter, the gramophone, which she used as a dictation device, and the motor car. Born on Christmas Day, Clara died on Good Friday, April 12, 1912, at the age of 91. She had requested a simple funeral and burial with her family in Massachusetts. So the body was taken from New Jersey, where she had been living. The friends accompanying her had to hire a covered express wagon. When the driver learned who he was carrying, he said, "My God, is this the body of Clara Barton? My father was a Confederate soldier, and at the Battle of Antietam, he was wounded in the neck and was bleeding to death when Miss Barton found him on the battlefield and bound up his wounds in time to save his life." There's no way to measure how many lives were saved during her lifetime and since by the organization Clara founded. Not bad for a small, shy child who was denied by her gender opportunities in advanced education and career, but who somehow knew she could always be useful. So we have time for some comments or questions. I don't know if anyone here has been involved with local Red Cross activities. No, I don't think she ever had any medical training. Women took care of people at home. She took care of her brother, and then she just jumped in apparently when she got to the battlefields. I'm not sure how much training some of the doctors had at the Civil War era either. And some of the doctors were more of a problem because this was still an era where everyone was not washing their hands and they'd go from a dead body to a live one. Yeah, and much of this was when she was 40 years old and up, and in a field where women were not, even this Red Cross, International Red Cross group, when she went there, she was the only woman, but somehow she never let that stop her. And she was always a very small person and did not have an imposing stature, but she had gained her, there was almost a legend or myth around her among the soldiers that she would show up as this angel. And of course, Florence Nightingale was another, was a similar thing in Europe. Apparently the two of them never met, but they did correspond. Community organization, that these are local people helping you, although I'm sure when there are large disasters, people come in from farther away if you need more help. And the religion, race, beliefs, attitudes of the people who need the help is irrelevant. It's everyone is being helped. And it is a international, it is a well-known symbol. It was to honor, the first fellow who came up with this was Swiss, and to honor him, they took the Swiss flag and reversed the colors. That's why you have the red on white where the Swiss flag is the other. And then one thing I meant to say before is that I don't tend to talk in terms of faith, but I think that what leads people like Clara Barton to do this is their faith, their belief in the importance of humanity and the ability of someone to make a difference. And sometimes I say that takes way more, it takes way more faith to believe that human beings can improve. Our track record isn't very good compared to the idea that some supernatural force will fix everything. And our closing words from Clara Barton: I cannot afford the luxury of a closed mind.